congratulated him. Up to that point, there had always been only one possibility, the original one. Now there were suddenly two. Let's take it one step further. If Durun, or you, had thrown another rock very quickly and hit the first rock before it got to Thaldor's window, it's possible that the first rock might have been knocked back to hit the crow instead of the window. Maybe, Geryon conceded doubtfully. Durun wasn't really that good at throwing rocks. I'm much better at it than Durun, the voice told him. That's the whole reason I came into existence in the first place. In a very special way, you are the rock that I have thrown. If you hit the other rock just right, you will turn it and make it go where it was originally intended to go. And if I don't, Thaldor's window gets broken. The figure of a naked woman with her arms chopped off and a sword thrust through her body was suddenly in front of Geryon. She shrieked and moaned at him, and the stumps of her arms spurted blood directly into his face. Geryon reached up to wipe off the blood, but his face was dry. Unconcerned, his horse walked through the gibbering ghost. "We have to get things back on the right course," the voice went on. "This certain thing you have to do is the key to the whole business. For a long time, what was supposed to happen, and what was actually happening, went off in different directions. Now they are starting to converge again. The point where they meet is the point where you will have to act. If you succeed, things will be all right again. If you don't, everything will keep going wrong, and the purpose for which the universe came into existence will fail."
"How long ago was it when this started?"
"Before the world was made. Even before the gods."
"Will I succeed?"
"I don't know. I know what's supposed to happen, not what will. There is something else you need to know, too. When this mistake occurred, it set off two separate lines of possibility. And a line of possibility has a kind of purpose. To have a purpose, there has to be awareness of that purpose. To put it rather simply, that's what I am. The awareness of the original purpose of the universe.
Only now there's another one, too, isn't there? Another awareness, I mean? One connected with the other set of possibilities?"
"Why, you're even brighter than I thought."
"And wouldn't it want to keep things going the wrong way?"
"I'm afraid so. Now we come to the important part. The spot in time where all of this is going to be decided one way or another. It's getting very close. And you have got to be ready."
"Why me?"
Geryon asked, brushing away a disconnected hand that appeared to be trying to clutch at his throat.
"Can't somebody else do it?"
"No," the voice told him. "That's not the way it works. The universe has been waiting for you for millions of years, more than you could even imagine. You have been hurtling toward this event since before the beginning of time. It is yours alone. You are the only one who can do what needs to be done. And it's the most important thing that will ever happen. Not just in this world, but in all of the worlds, in all of the universe. There are whole races of men on worlds so far away that the light from their suns will never reach this world. And they will cease to exist if you fail. They will never know you, nor thank you. But their entire existence depends on you. The other line of possibility leads to absolute chaos and the ultimate destruction of the universe. But you and I lead to something else."
"What?"
"If you are successful, you will live to see it happen."
"All right. What do I have to do? Now, I mean."
You have enormous power. It has been given to you so that you can do what you have to do. But you have got to learn how to use it. Dalgareth and Polgara are trying to help you learn, so stop fighting with them about it. You've got to be ready when the time comes, and the time is much closer than you might think.
A decapitated figure stood in the trail, holding its head by the hair with its right hand. As Geryon approached, the figure raised the head. The twisted mouth shrieked curses at him. After he had ridden through the ghost, Geryon tried to speak to the mind within his mind again, but it seemed to be gone for the moment. They rode slowly past the tumbled stones of a ruined farmstead. Ghosts clustered thickly on the stones, beckoning and calling seductively.
"A disproportionate number seem to be women,"
Aunt Paul observed calmly to Mr. Wolf.
"It was a peculiarity of the race," Wolf replied. 8 out of 9 births were female. It made certain adjustments necessary in the customary relationships between men and women.
"I imagine you found that entertaining," she said dryly.
"The Murrags didn't look at things precisely the way other races do. Marriage never gained much status among them. They were quite liberal about certain things."
"Oh, is that the term for it?"
"Try not to be so narrow-minded, Paul. The society functioned. That's what counts."
"There is a bit more to it than that, Father. What about their cannibalism?"
"That was a mistake. Somebody misinterpreted a passage in one of their sacred texts, that's all. They did it out of a sense of religious obligation, not out of appetite. On the whole, I rather liked the Murrags. They were generous, friendly, very honest with each other. They enjoyed life. If it had not been for the gold here, they'd probably have worked out their little aberration."
Geryon had forgotten about the gold. As they crossed a small stream, he looked down into the sparkling water and saw the butter-yellow flecks glittering among the pebbles on the bottom. A naked ghost suddenly appeared before him.
"Don't you think I'm beautiful?"
she leered. Then she took hold of the sides of the great slash that ran up her abdomen, pulled it open, and spilled out her entrails in a pile on the bank of the stream. Geryon gagged and clenched his teeth together.
"Don't think about the gold," the voice in his mind said. "The ghosts come at you through your greed. If you think about the gold, you will go mad."
They rode on, and Geryon tried to push the thought of gold out of his mind. Mr. Wolf, however, continued to talk about it.
"That's always been the problem with gold. It seems to attract the worst kind of people. The Tonedrans, in this case."
"They were trying to stamp out cannibalism, Father. That's a custom most people find repugnant."
"I wonder how serious they'd have been about it if all of that gold hadn't been lying on the bed of every stream in Maragor."
Aunt Paul averted her eyes from the ghost of a child impaled on a Tonedran spear.
"And now, no one has the gold. Mara saw to that."
"Yes,"
Wolf agreed, lifting his face to listen to the dreadful wail that seemed to come from everywhere. He winced at a particularly shrill note in the wailing.
"I wish he wouldn't scream so loud."
They passed the ruins of what appeared to have been a temple. The white stones were tumbled and grass grew up among them. A broad tree standing nearby was festooned with hanging bodies, twisting and swinging on their ropes.
"Let us down," the bodies murmured. "Let us down."
"Father,"
Aunt Paul said sharply, pointing at the meadow beyond the fallen temple.
"Over there. Those people are real."
A procession of robed and hooded figures moved slowly through the meadow, chanting in unison to the sound of a mournfully tolling bell supported on a heavy pole that they carried on their shoulders.
"The monks of Mar Terran," Wolf said. "Tonedra's conscience. They aren't anything to worry about."
One of the hooded figures looked up and saw them.
"Go back," he shouted.
He broke away from the others and ran toward them, recoiling often from things Geryon could not see.
"Go back," he cried again. "Save yourselves. You approach the very center of this horror. Mar Aemon lies just beyond that hill. Mara himself rages through its haunted streets."
Chapter 6. The procession of monks moved on, the sound of their chanting and slowly tolling bell growing fainter as they crossed the meadow. Mr. Wolf seemed deep in thought, the fingers of his good hand stroking his beard. Finally, he sighed, rather wryly.
"I suppose we might as well deal with him here and now, Paul. He'll just follow us if we don't."
"You're wasting your time, Father," Aunt Paul replied. "There is no way to reason with him. We've tried that before."
"You're probably right. But we should try, at least. Aljor would be disappointed if we didn't. Maybe when he finds out what's happening, he will come around to the point where we can at least talk to him."
A piercing wail echoed across the sunny meadow, and Mr. Wolf made a sour face.
"You'd think that he'd have shrieked himself out by now. All right, let's go to Mar Aemon."
He turned his horse toward the hill the wild-eyed monk had pointed out to them. A maimed ghost gibbered at him from the air in front of his face.
"Oh, stop that," he said irritably.
With a startled flicker, the ghost disappeared. There had, perhaps, been a road leading over the hill at some time in the past. The faint track of it was dimly visible through the grass. But the 32 centuries which had passed since the last living foot had touched its surface had all but erased it. They wound to the top of the hill and looked down into the ruins of Mar Aemon. Geryon, still detached and unmoved, perceived and deduced things about the city he would not have otherwise noted. Though the destruction had been nearly total, the shape of the city was clearly evident. The street, for there was only one, was laid out in a spiral winding in toward a broad circular plaza in the precise center of the ruins. With a peculiar flash of insight, Geryon became immediately convinced that the city had been designed by a woman. Men's minds ran to straight lines, but women thought more in terms of circles. With Aunt Paul and Mr. Wolf in the lead, and the rest following in a wooden-faced unconsciousness, they started down the hill to the city. Geryon rode at the rear, trying to ignore the ghosts rising from the earth to confront him with their nudity and their hideous maiming. The wailing sound, which they had heard from the moment they had entered Meragor, grew louder and more distinct. The wail had sometimes seemed to be a chorus, confused and distorted by echoes. But now, Geryon realized, it was one single mighty voice, filled with a grief so vast that it reverberated through all of the kingdom. As they approached the city, a terrible wind seemed to come up, deadly chill, and filled with an overpowering charnel-house stench. As Geryon reached automatically to draw his cloak tighter about him, he saw that the cloak did not in any way react to the wind. Nor did the tall grass through which they rode bend before it. He considered it. If the wind did not move the grass, it could not be a real wind. Furthermore, if the horses could not hear the wails, they could not be real wailing either. He grew colder and shivered, even as he told himself that the chill, like the wind and the grief-laden howling, was spiritual rather than real. Although Mar Aemon, when he had first glimpsed it from the top of the hill, had appeared to be in total ruin, when they entered the city, Geryon was startled to see the substantial walls of houses and public buildings surrounding him. And somewhere, not far away, he seemed to hear the sound of laughing children. There was also the sound of singing off in the distance.
"Why does he keep doing this?"
Aunt Paul asked sadly.
It doesn't do any good.
It's all he has, Paul,
Mr. Wolfe replied.
It always ends the same, though.
I know. But for a little while it helps him to forget.
There are things we would all like to forget, Father. This is not the way to do it.
Wolfe looked admiringly at the substantial seeming houses around them.
It is very good, you know.
Naturally. He is a god, after all. But it's still not good for him.
It was not until Barak's horse inadvertently stepped directly through one of the walls, disappearing through the solid-looking stone and then re-emerging several yards farther down the street, that Geryon understood what his aunt and grandfather were talking about. The walls, the buildings, the whole city was an illusion, a memory. The chill wind with its stink of corruption seemed to grow stronger and carried with it now the added reek of smoke. Though Geryon could still see the sunlight shining brightly on the grass, it seemed for some reason that it was growing noticeably darker. The laughter of the children and the distant singing faded. Geryon heard screams. A Tolnedran legionnaire, in burnished breastplate and plumed helmet, as solid-looking as the walls around them, came running down the long curve of the street. His sword dripped blood, his face was fixed in a hideous grin, and his eyes were wild. Hacked and mutilated bodies sprawled in the street now, and there was blood everywhere. The wailing climbed into a piercing shriek as the illusion moved on toward its dreadful climax. The spiral street opened at last into the broad circular plaza at the center of Mar Amon. The icy wind seemed to howl through the burning city, and the dreadful sounds of swords chopping through flesh and bone seemed to fill Geryon's entire mind. The air grew even darker. The stones of the plaza were thick with the illusory memory of uncounted scores of Marag dead lying beneath rolling clouds of dense smoke. But what stood in the center of the plaza was not an illusion nor even a ghost. The figure towered and seemed to shimmer with a terrible presence, a reality that was in no way dependent upon the mind of the observer for its existence. In its arms, it held the body of a slaughtered child that seemed somehow to be the sum and total of all of the dead of haunted Maragor, and its face, lifted in anguish above the body of that dead child, was ravaged by an expression of inhuman grief. The figure wailed, and Geryon, even in the half-somnolent state that protected his sanity, felt the hair on the back of his neck trying to rise in horror. Mr. Wolfe grimaced and climbed down from his saddle. Carefully stepping over the illusions of bodies littering the plaza, he approached the enormous presence.
"Lord Mara," he said, respectfully bowing to the figure. Mara howled. "Lord Mara," Wolf said again, "I would not lightly intrude myself upon thy grief, but I must speak with thee."
The dreadful face contorted, and great tears streamed down the god's cheeks. Wordlessly, Mara held out the body of the child and lifted his face and wailed.
"Lord Mara," Wolf tried once again, more insistent this time.
Mara closed his eyes and bowed his head, sobbing over the body of the child.
"It's useless, Father," Aunt Paul told the old man. "When he's like this, you cannot reach him."
"Leave me, Belgarath," Mara said, still weeping.
His huge voice rolled and throbbed in Geryon's mind.
"Leave me to my grief. Lord Mara, the day of the fulfillment of the prophecy is at hand." "What is that to me?" Mara sobbed, clutching the body of the child closer. "Will the prophecy restore my slaughtered children? I am beyond its reach. Leave me alone." The fate of the world hinges upon the outcome of events, which will happen very soon, Lord Mara. The kingdoms of East and West are girding for the last war, and Torak One-Eye, thine accursed brother, stirs in his slumber and will soon awaken.
Let him awaken,
Mara replied, and bowed down over the body in his arms as a storm of fresh weeping swept over him.
Wilt thou then submit to his dominion, Lord Mara?
Aunt Paul asked him.
I am beyond his dominion, Polgara. I will not leave this land of my murdered children, and no man nor god will intrude upon me here. Let Torak have the world if he wants it.
We might as well leave, Father. Nothing's going to move him.
Lord Mara, Mr. Wolf said to the weeping god, we have brought before thee the instruments of prophecy. Wilt thou bless them before we go?
I have no blessings, Belgarath, Mara replied. Only curses for the savage children of Nedra. Take these strangers and go.
Lord Mara,
Aunt Paul said firmly,
a part is reserved for thee in the working out of the prophecy. The iron destiny which compels us all compels thee as well. Each must play that part laid out for him from the beginning of days, for in the day that the prophecy is turned aside from its terrible course, the world will be unmade.
Let it be unmade, Mara groaned. It holds no more joy for me. So let it perish. My grief is eternal, and I will not abandon it, though the cost be the unmaking of all that has been made. Take these children of the prophecy and depart.
Mr. Wolf bowed with resignation, turned, and came back toward the rest of them. His expression registered a certain hopeless disgust.
Wait!
Mara roared suddenly. The images of the city and its dead wavered and shimmered away.
What is this?
The god demanded. Mr. Wolf turned quickly.
What hast thou done? Don Belgarath,
Mara accused, suddenly towering into immensity.
And thou, Polgara, is my grief now an amusement for thee? Wilt thou cast my sorrow into my teeth?
My lord,
Aunt Paul seemed taken aback by the god's sudden fury.
Monstrous,
Mara roared.
Monstrous!
His huge face convulsed with rage. In terrible anger, he strode toward them and then stopped, directly in front of the horse of Princess Zinedra.
I will rend thy flesh,
he shrieked at her.
I will fill thy brain with the worms of madness, daughter of Nedra. I will sink thee in torment and horror for all the days of thy life.
Leave her alone,
Aunt Paul said sharply.
Nay, Polgara, upon her will fall the brunt of my wrath.
His dreadful clutching fingers reached out toward the uncomprehending princess, but she stared blankly through him, unflinching and unaware. The god hissed with frustration and whirled to confront Mr. Wolf.
Tricked!
He howled at him.
Her mind is asleep.
They are all asleep, Lord Mara. Threats and horrors do not mean anything to them. Shriek and howl until the sky falls down. She cannot hear thee.
I will punish thee for this, Belgarath. And Polgara as well. You will all taste pain and terror for this arrogant despite of me. I will wring the sleep from the minds of these intruders, and they will know the agony and madness I will visit upon them all.
He swelled suddenly into vastness.
That's enough, Mara. Stop.
The voice was Geryon's, but Geryon knew that it was not he who spoke. The spirit of Mara turned on him, raising his vast arm to strike, but Geryon felt himself slide from his horse to approach the vast, threatening figure.
"Your vengeance stops here, Mara,"
the voice coming from Geryon's mouth said. "The girl is bound to my purpose. You will not touch her." Geryon realized with a certain alarm that he had been placed between the raging god and the sleeping princess.
"Move out of my way, boy, lest I slay thee,"
Mara threatened.
"Use your mind, Mara," the voice told him. "If you haven't howled it empty by now, you know who I am."
"I will have her. I will give her a multitude of lives and tear each one from her quivering flesh."
"No,"
the voice replied.
"You won't."
The god Mera drew himself up again, raising his dreadful arms, but at the same time his eyes were probing, and more than his eyes. Geryon once again felt a vast touch on his mind, as he had in Queen Salmistra's throne room when the spirit of Issa had touched him.
A dreadful recognition began to dawn in Mara's weeping eyes. His raised arms fell.
"Give her to me. Take the others and go. But give the Tornedron to me. I beg it of thee."
"No."
What happened then was not sorcery. Geryon knew it instantly. The noise was not there, nor that strange rushing surge that always accompanied sorcery. Instead, there seemed to be a terrible pressure as the full force of Mara's mind was directed crushingly at him. Then, the mind within his mind responded. The power was so vast that the world itself was not large enough to contain it. It did not strike back at Mara, for that dreadful collision would have shattered the world, but it stood rather calmly unmoved and immovable against the raging torrent of Mara's fury. For a fleeting moment, Geryon shared the awareness of the mind within his mind, and he shuddered back from its immensity. In that instant, he saw the birth of uncounted suns swirling in vast spirals against the velvet blackness of the void, their birth and gathering into galaxies and ponderously turning nebula, encompassing but a moment. And beyond that, he looked full in the face of time itself, seeing its beginning and its ending in one awful glimpse. Mara fell back.
"Must submit,"
he said hoarsely, and then he bowed to Geryon, his ravaged face strangely humble. He turned away and buried his face in his hands, weeping uncontrollably.
"Your grief will end, Mara," the voice said gently. "One day, you will find joy again."
"Never," the god sobbed. "My grief will last forever."
"Forever's a very long time, Mara," the voice replied, "and only I can see the end of it."
The weeping god did not answer, but moved away from them, and the sound of his wailing echoed again through the ruins of Mar Emon. Mr. Wolf and Aunt Paul were both staring at Geryon with stunned faces. When the old man spoke, his voice was awed.
"Is it possible?"
"Aren't you the one who keeps saying that anything is possible, Belgareth?"
"We didn't know you could intervene directly," Aunt Paul said.
"I nudge things a bit from time to time, Make a few suggestions. If you think back carefully, you might even remember some of them.
Is the boy aware of any of this?
Of course. We had a little talk about it.
How much did you tell him?
As much as he could understand. Don't worry, Palgara. I'm not going to hurt him. He realizes how important all of this is now. He knows that he needs to prepare himself and that he doesn't have a great deal of time for it. I think you had better leave here now. The Tolnedran girl's presence is causing Mera a great deal of pain.
Aunt Paul looked as if she wanted to say more, but she glanced once at the shadowy figure of the god weeping not far away and nodded. She turned to her horse and led the way out of the ruins. Mr. Wolf fell in beside Geryon after they had remounted to follow her.
"Perhaps we could talk as we rode along," he suggested. "I have a great many questions."
"He's gone, Grandfather,"
Geryon told him.
"Oh," Wolf answered with obvious disappointment.
It was nearing sundown by then, and they stopped for the night in a grove about a mile away from Mar Emon. Since they had left the ruins, they had seen no more of the maimed ghosts. After the others had been fed and sent to their blankets, Aunt Paul, Geryon, and Mr. Wolf sat around their small fire. Since the presence in his mind had left him, following the meeting with Mara, Geryon had felt himself sinking deeper toward sleep. All emotion was totally gone now, and he seemed no longer able to think independently.
"Can we talk to the, other one?"
Mr. Wolf asked hopefully.
"He's not there right now,"
Geryon replied.
"Then he's not always with you?"
"Not always.
Sometimes he goes away for months, sometimes even longer. He's been there for quite a long while this time,
ever since Asherak burned up."
"What exactly is he when he's with you?"
the old man asked curiously. Geryon tapped his head.
"In here." "Have you been awake ever since we entered Maragor?"
Aunt Paul asked.
"Not exactly awake,"
Geryon yawned.
"Part of me was asleep." "You could see the ghosts?"
"Yes."
"But they didn't frighten you?"
"No."
"Some of them surprised me, and one of them made me sick."
Wolf looked up quickly.
"It wouldn't make you sick now, though, would it?"
"No, I don't think so. Right at first I could still feel things like that a little bit. Now I can't."
Wolf looked thoughtfully at the fire, as if looking for a way to phrase his next question.
"What did the other one in your head say to you when you talked together?"
"He told me that something had happened a long time ago that wasn't supposed to happen, and that I was supposed to fix it."
Wolf laughed shortly.
"That's a succinct way of putting it. Did he say anything about how it was going to turn out?"
"He doesn't know."
Wolf sighed.
"I had hoped that maybe we'd picked up an advantage somewhere, but I guess not. It looks like both prophecies are still equally valid."
Aunt Paul was looking steadily at Geryon.
"Do you think you will be able to remember any of this when you wake up again?"
"I think so."
"All right, then. Listen carefully. There are two prophecies, both leading toward the same event. The Grolems and the rest of the Angoraks are following one. We are following the other. The event turns out differently at the end of each prophecy."
"I see,"
he yawned.
"Nothing in either prophecy excludes anything that will happen in the other until they meet in that event. The course of everything that follows will be decided by how that event turns out. One prophecy will succeed. The other will fail. Everything that has happened and will happen comes together at that point and becomes one. The mistake will be erased. and the universe will go in one direction or the other, as if that were the direction it had been going from its very beginning. The only real difference is that something that is very important will never happen if we fail.
Geryon nodded, feeling suddenly very tired.
Belden calls it the theory of convergent destinies, Mr. Wolf said. Two equally possible possibilities. Oh, Belden can be very pompous sometimes.
It's not an uncommon failing, Father,
Aunt Paul told him.
I think I'd like to sleep now,
Geryon said. Wolf and Aunt Paul exchanged a quick glance.
All right,
Aunt Paul said. She rose and took him by the arm and led him to his blankets. After she had covered him, drawing the blankets up snugly, she laid one cool hand on his forehead.
Sleep, my Belgarian,
she murmured. And he did.
Part 2. The Vale of Aldur. Chapter 7. They were all standing in a circle with their hands joined when they awoke. Tenedra was holding Geryon's left hand, and Durnik was on his right. Geryon's awareness came flooding back as sleep left him. The breeze was fresh and cool, and the morning sun was very bright. Yellow-brown foothills rose directly in front of them, and the haunted plain of Meragor lay behind. Silk looked around sharply as he awoke, his eyes wary. "Where are we?" he asked quickly.
"On the northern edge of Meragor, about 80 leagues east of Tol Rain."
"And how long were we asleep?"
"A week or so."
Silk kept looking around, adjusting his mind to the passage of time and distance.
"Ah, well, I guess it was necessary,"
he conceded finally. Hetar went immediately to check the horses, and Barak began massaging the back of his neck with both hands.
"I feel as if I've been sleeping on a pile of rocks."
"Walk around a bit. That will work the stiffness out,"
Aunt Paul advised. Tenedra had not removed her hand from Geryon's, and he wondered if he should mention it to her. Her hand felt very warm and small in his, and on the whole it was not unpleasant. He decided not to say anything about it. Hetar was frowning when he came back.
"One of the pack mares is with Folbergarath." "How long has she got to go?"
Wolf asked, looking quickly at him.
"It is hard to say for sure. No more than a month. It is her first."
"Oh, we can break down her pack and distribute the weight among the other horses," Durnik suggested. "Oh, she'll be all right if she doesn't have to carry anything."
Maybe,
Hetar sounded dubious. Mundralin had been studying the yellowed foothills directly ahead.
"We are being watched, Belgarath," he said somberly, pointing at several wispy columns of smoke rising toward the blue morning sky.
Mr. Wolf squinted at the smoke and made a sour face.
"Yes, gold hunters, probably. They hover around the borders of Meragor like vultures over a sick cow. Take a look, Paul."
But Aunt Paul's eyes already had that distant look in them as she scanned the foothills ahead.
"Arins,"
she said.
"Sindars, Tolnedrans, a couple of Drasnians. Oh, they're not very bright."
"Any Murgos?"
"No."
"Ah, common rabble, then," Mandarallan observed. "Such scavengers will not impede us significantly."
"I'd like to avoid a fight, if possible," Wolf told him. "These incidental skirmishes are dangerous, and they don't really accomplish anything."
He shook his head with disgust.
"We'll never be able to convince them that we are not carrying gold out of Meragor, though. So I guess there's no help for it."
"If gold is all they want, why don't we just give them some?" Silk suggested.
"I didn't bring all that much with me, Silk." "It doesn't have to be real," Silk said, his eyes bright.
He went to one of the pack horses, came back with several large pieces of canvas, and quickly cut them into foot-wide squares. Then he took one of the squares and laid a double handful of gravel in the center. He pulled up the corners and wrapped a stout piece of cord around them, forming a heavy-looking pouch. He hefted it a few times.
Looks about like a sack full of gold, wouldn't you say?
He's going to do something clever again, Barak said.
Silk smirked at him and quickly made up several more pouches.
I'll take the lead, he said, hanging the pouches on their saddles. Just follow me, and let me do the talking. How many of them are up there, Pogra?
About 20, she replied.
Oh, that will work out just fine, he stated confidently. Shall we go?
They mounted their horses and started across the ground toward the broad mouth of a dry wash that opened out onto the plain. Silk rode at the front, his eyes seemingly everywhere. As they entered the mouth of the wash, Garion heard a shrill whistle and saw several furtive movements ahead of them. He was very conscious of the steep banks of the wash on either side of them.
I'm going to need a bit of open ground to work with, Silk told them. There.
He pointed with his chin at a spot where the slope of the bank was a bit more gradual. When they reached the spot, he turned his horse sharply.
Now, he barked, ride!
They followed him. Scrambling up the bank and kicking up a great deal of gravel, a thick cloud of choking yellow dust rose into the air as they clawed their way up out of the wash. Shouts of dismay came from the scrubby thorn bushes at the upper end of the wash, and a group of rough-looking men broke out into the open, running hard up through the knee-high brown grass to head them off. A black-bearded man, closer and more desperate than the rest, jumped out in front of them, brandishing a rust-pitted sword. Without hesitation, Mandaralan rode him down. The black-bearded man howled as he rolled and tumbled beneath the churning hooves of the huge warhorse. When they reached the hilltop above the wash, they gathered in a tight group.
"This will do," Silk said, looking around at the rounded terrain. "All I need is for the mob to have enough room to think about casualties. I definitely want them to be thinking about casualties."
An arrow buzzed toward them, and Mandaralan brushed it almost contemptuously out of the air with his shield.
"Aye, stop!"
one of the brigands shouted. He was a lean, pock-faced Sindar with crude bandages wrapped around one leg, wearing a dirty green tunic.
"Who says so?"
Silk yelled back insolently.
"On Kraldor,"
the bandaged man announced importantly.
"Kraldor the robber. You've probably heard of me."
"I can't say that I have,"
Silk replied pleasantly.
"Leave your gold, and your women," Kraldor ordered. "Maybe I'll let you live."
"If you get out of our way, maybe we'll let you live."
"I've got 50 men," Kraldor threatened. "All desperate like me."
"You've got 20, Silk corrected. "Runaway serfs, cowardly peasants, and sneak thieves. My men are trained warriors. Not only that, we're mounted, and you are on foot."
"Leave your gold," the self-proclaimed robber insisted.
"Why don't you come and take it?"
"Let's go,"
Kraldor barked at his men. He lunged forward. A couple of his outlaws rather hesitantly followed him through the brown grass, but the rest hung back, eyeing Mandaralan, Barak, and Hetar apprehensively. After a few paces, Kraldor realized that his men were not with him. He stopped and spun around.
"You cowards," he raged. "If we don't hurry, the others are going to get here. We won't get any of the gold then."
"I'll tell you what, Kraldor, we are in kind of a hurry. And we've got more gold than we can conveniently carry."
He unslung one of his bags of gravel from his saddle and shook it suggestively.
"Here."
Negligently, he tossed the bag into the grass off to one side. Then he took another bag and tossed it over beside the first. At his quick gesture, the others all threw their bags on the growing heap.
"There you are, Kraldor. 10 bags of good yellow gold that you can have without a fight. If you want more, you'll have to bleed for it."
The rough-looking men behind Kroldor looked at each other and began moving to either side, their eyes fixed greedily on the heap of bags lying in the tall grass.
"Your men are having thoughts about mortality, Kroldor," Silk said dryly. "There's enough gold there to make them all rich, and rich men don't take unnecessary risks."
Kroldor glared at him.
"I won't forget this," he growled.
"Oh, I'm sure you won't. We're coming through now. I suggest that you get out of our way."
Morak and Hetar moved up to flank Mandorallan, and the three of them started deliberately forward at a slow, menacing walk. Kroldor, the robber, stood his ground until the last moment, then turned and scurried out of their path, spouting curses.
"Let's go," Silk snapped.
They thumped their heels to their horses' flanks and charged through at a gallop. Behind them, the outlaws circled and then broke and ran toward the heap of canvas bags. Several ugly little fights broke out almost immediately, and three men were down before anyone thought to open one of the bags. The howls of rage could be heard quite clearly for some distance. Morak was laughing when they finally reined in their horses after a couple of miles of hard riding.
"Poor Kroldor," he chortled. "You are an evil little man, Silk."
"Oh, I've made a study of the baser side of man's nature," Silk replied innocently. "I can usually find a way to make it work for me."
"Kroldor's men are going to blame him for the way things turned out."
"I know. But then, that's one of the hazards of leadership."
"They might even kill him," Hetar observed.
"Oh, I certainly hope so. I'd be terribly disappointed in them if they didn't."
They pushed on through the yellow foothills for the rest of the day and camped that night in a well-concealed little canyon where the light from their fire would not betray their location to the brigands who infested the region. The next morning, they started out early, and by noon, they were in the mountains. They rode on up among the rocky crags, moving through a thick forest of dark green firs and spruces, where the air was cool and spicy. Although it was still summer in the lowlands, the first signs of autumn had begun to appear at the higher elevations. The leaves on the underbrush had begun to turn, the air had a faint, smoky haze, and there was frost on the ground each morning when they awoke. The weather held fair, however, and they made good time. Then, late one afternoon, after they had been in the mountains for a week or more, a heavy bank of clouds moved in from the west, bringing with it a damp chill. Geryon untied his cloak from the back of his saddle and pulled it around his shoulders as he rode, shivering as the afternoon grew colder. Durnik lifted his face and sniffed at the air.
"I will have snow before morning," he predicted.
Geryon could also smell the chill, dusty odor of snow in the air. He nodded glumly. Mr. Wolf grunted,
"I knew this was too good to last,"
and then shrugged.
"Oh, well, we have all lived through winters before."
When Geryon poked his head out of the tent the next morning, an inch of snow lay on the ground beneath the dark firs. Soft flakes were drifting down, settling soundlessly and concealing everything more than 100 yards away in a filmy haze. The air was cold and gray, and the horses, looking very dark under a dusting of snow, stamped their feet and flicked their ears at the fairy touch of the snowflakes settling on them. Their breath steamed in the damp cold. Tenedra emerged from the tent she shared with Aunt Paul with a squeal of delight. Snow, Geryon realized, was probably a rarity in Tol Hanoth, and the tiny girl romped through the soft, drifting flakes with a childish abandon. He smiled tolerantly until a well-aimed snowball caught him in the side of the head. Then he chased her, pelting her with snowballs while she dodged in and out among the trees, laughing and squealing. When he finally caught her, he was determined to wash her face with the snow, but she exuberantly threw her arms around his neck and kissed him, her cold little nose rubbing against his cheek and her eyelashes thick with snowflakes. He didn't realize the full extent of her deceitfulness until she had already poured a handful of snow down the back of his neck. Then she broke free and ran toward the tents, hooting with laughter, while he tried to shake the snow out of the back of his tunic before it all melted. By midday, however, the snow on the ground had turned to slush, and the drifting flakes had become a steady, unpleasant drizzle. They rode up a narrow ravine under its dripping firs, while a torrent-like stream roared over boulders beside them. Mr. Wolf finally called a halt.
"We're getting close to the western border of Torremugos. I think it's time we started to take a few precautions."
"I will ride out in front,"
Hetar offered quickly.
"I don't think that's a very good idea," Wolf replied. "You tend to get distracted when you see Murgos."
"I'll do it," Silk said. He had pulled his hood up, but water still dripped from the end of his long pointed nose. "I'll stay about a half a mile ahead and keep my eyes open." Wolf nodded.
"Whistle if you see anything."
"Right," Silk said as he started off up the ravine at a trot. Late that afternoon, the rain began to freeze as it hit, coating the rocks and trees with gray ice. They rounded a large outcropping of rock and found Silk waiting for them. The stream had turned to a trickle, and the walls of the ravine had opened out onto the steep sides of the mountain.
"We've got about an hour of daylight left," the little man said. "What do you think? Should we go on, or do you want to drop back down the ravine a bit and set up for the night?"
Mr. Wolf squinted at the sky and then at the mountainside ahead. The steep slope was covered with stunted trees, and the timberline lay not far above them.
"We have to go around this, and then down the other side. It's only a couple of miles. Let's go ahead."
Silk nodded and led out again. They rounded the shoulder of the mountain and looked down into a deep gorge that separated them from the peak they had crossed 2 days before. The rain had slackened with the approach of evening, and Geryon could see the other side of the gorge clearly. It was no more than half a mile away, and his eyes caught a movement near the rim.
"What's that?"
he asked, pointing. Mr. Wolf brushed the ice out of his beard.
"I was afraid of that."
"What?"
"It's an Algroth." With a shudder of revulsion, Geryon remembered the scaly, goat-faced apes that had attacked them in Arendia.
"Hadn't we better run, then?"
"It can't get to us," Wolf replied. "The gorge is at least a mile deep. The Grolems have turned their beasts loose, though. It is something we're going to have to watch out for."
He motioned for them to continue. Faintly, distorted by the wind that blew perpetually down the yawning gorge, Geryon could hear the barking yelps of the Algroth on the far side, as it communicated with the rest of its pack. Soon a dozen of the loathsome creatures were scampering along the rocky rim of the gorge, barking to one another and keeping pace with the party as they rode around the steep mountain face toward a shallow draw on the far side. The draw led away from the gorge. After a mile, they stopped for the night in the shelter of a grove of scrubby spruce. It was colder the next morning, and still cloudy, but the rain had stopped. They rode on back down toward the mouth of the draw and continued following the rim of the gorge. The face on the other side fell away in a sheer, dizzying drop for thousands of feet to the tiny-looking ribbon of the river at the bottom. The Algroths still kept pace with them, barking and yelping and looking across with a dreadful hunger. There were other things as well, dimly seen back among the trees on the other side. One of them, huge and shaggy, seemed even to have a human body, but its head was the head of a beast. A herd of swift-moving animals galloped along the far rim, manes and tails tossing.
"Look!"
Tenedra exclaimed, pointing.
"Wild horses!"
"Those are not horses,"
Hetar said grimly.
"They look like horses."
"They may look like it, but they are not."
"Hrulgin," Mr. Wolf said shortly. "What is that?" "A Hrulgur is a four-legged animal, like a horse, but it has fangs instead of teeth, and clawed feet instead of hooves."
"But that would mean..."
the princess broke off, her eyes wide.
"Yes, they are meat-eaters."
She shuddered.
How dreadful.
That gorge is getting narrower, Belgarath, Barak growled. I'd rather not have any of those things on the same side with us. We'll be all right. As I remember, it narrows down to about 100 yards and then widens out again. They won't be able to get across. I hope your memory hasn't failed you.
The sky above looked ragged, tattered by a gusty wind. Vultures soared and circled over the gorge, and ravens flapped from tree to tree, croaking and squawking to one another. Aunt Paul watched the birds with a look of stern disapproval, but said nothing. They rode on. The gorge grew narrower, and soon they could see the brutish faces of the Algroths on the other side clearly. When the Hrulgan, manes tossing in the wind, opened their mouths to whinny to each other, their long pointed teeth were plainly visible. Then, at the narrowest point of the gorge, a party of mail-shirted Murgos rode out onto the opposite precipice. Their horses were lathered from hard riding, and the Murgos themselves were gaunt-faced and travel-stained. They stopped and waited until Garion and his friends were opposite them. At the very edge, staring first across the gorge and then down at the river far below, stood Brill.
"What capture?"
Silk called in a bantering tone that had a hard edge just below the surface. "We thought, perhaps, you had gotten lost."
"Not very likely, Keldar. How did you get across to that side?"
"Oh, you go back that way about 4 days' ride,"
Silk shouted, pointing back the way they had come.
"If you look very carefully, you'll find the canyon that leads up here. Oh, it shouldn't take you more than a day or two to find it."
One of the Murgos pulled a short bow out from beneath his left leg and set an arrow to it. He pointed the arrow at Silk, drew back the string, and released it. Silk watched the arrow calmly as it fell down into the gorge, spinning in a long, slow-looking spiral.
"Nice shot," he called.
"Don't be an idiot,"
Brill snapped at the Murgo with the bow. He looked back at Silk.
"I've heard a great deal about you, Keldar," he said.
"Oh, and has developed a certain reputation," Silk replied modestly.
"One of these days, I'll have to find out if you are as good as they say."
"That particular curiosity could be the first symptom of a fatal disease.
For one of us, at least."
"I look forward to our next meeting, then," Silk told him. "I hope you'll excuse us, my dear fellow. Pressing business, you know."
"Keep an eye out behind you, Keldar," Brill threatened. "One day, I will be there."
"I always keep an eye out behind me, Kordach," Silk called back. "So don't be too surprised if I'm waiting for you. It's been wonderful chatting with you. We'll have to do it again. Soon."
The Murgo with the bow shot another arrow. It followed his first into the gorge. Silk laughed and led the party away from the brink of the precipice.
"What a splendid fellow," he said, as they rode away.
He looked up at the murky sky overhead, and what an absolutely beautiful day. The clouds thickened and grew black as the day wore on. The wind picked up until it howled among the trees. Mr. Wolf led them away from the gorge which separated them from Brill and his Murgos, moving steadily toward the northeast. They set up for the night in a rock-strewn basin just below the timberline. Aunt Paul prepared a meal of thick stew. As soon as they had finished eating it, they let the fire go out.
"There's no point in lighting beacons for them," Wolf observed. "They can't get across the gorge, can they? It is still better not to take any chances."
Wolf walked away from the last few embers of the dying fire and looked out into the darkness. On an impulse, Garion followed him.
"How much farther is it to the Vale, Grandfather?"
"About 70 leagues. We can't make very good time up here in the mountains."
"Yes, and the weather's getting worse, too."
"I noticed that."
What happens if we get to a real snowstorm?
We take shelter until it blows over.
What if...
Geryon. I know it's only natural, but sometimes you sound a great deal like your aunt.